welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, and welcome to the second and final program featuring the well-known and much-loved Australian film, television and radio identity, Bud Tingwall. Bud was the featured speaker at a day celebrating older people, conducted by the Melba Project at Hillsville, Victoria in April 2008. Bud regaled a large audience with stories of his entry into radio and captivated them as his story unfolded to include television and film. We pick up this week with Bud sharing more of his stories and experiences, including the fascinating story of how he got his nickname, Bud. Now, here's Bud.
It's extraordinary what's happened. I always thought that a lot of our actors were 1,000,000% better than most of us realised in Australia. Then you discovered that, you know, I had to go to England to finish a movie called The Shirelee way back in 1956. And when you got there, you know, you had Peter Finch as a huge international star. He was playing the lead in The Shirelee. And you had Aussies everywhere. Billy Kerr, who used to do comedy work in Australia, he and I were up for the same part in a film called Sons of Matthew. They kept telling me that it was out of Bill and I, but it might be Bill, and so I was offered the lead in another movie, so I grabbed that, and they said, oh, what are we going to do? I said, well, you've got Bill Kerr. I said, well, not really. Bill's got on a tramp ship and working his way to England. When by the time we got to England a couple of years later, he was a huge star in the British theatre, particularly variety. And he, you know, we did a few things together and the odd movie and things like that. But everywhere you looked, Australians were at the very top of the business, particularly in theatre. And people like Joy Nichols, who once won her final of the Do You Want to Be an Actor show, she was up there with Jimmy Edwards and all the top people. It was very exciting. What was kind of sad, that very few Aussies ever realised it, because there wasn't that much publicity. It was very hard to get publicity, as the Americans can even today. We still find it hard. I'm amazed that Australians are starting to realise that, yes, we do win Academy Awards, like Geoffrey Rush and Cate Blanchett. It's pretty extraordinary. There was a lot of information kicking around many, many years ago that you had to shut up and pretend not to be Australian, otherwise you wouldn't get any work. These days, if you can prove you are Australian, you can get work, which is, I think, terrific. Also, we're quite good at accents. We can do American accents. I thought Russell's performance in Beautiful Mind was just extraordinary. And the wonderful thing about his accent, you didn't notice whether what accent he was wearing, using. It was dead right and very, very subtle. And I was always pleased at his success because he was one of the leads in Neighbours. And you find that Guy Pearce was in Neighbours. And I think Cate Blanchett was in Home and Away. And, you know, the young actors have got to be careful. I occasionally lecture, or used to before I got sick, student actors at Victorian College of the Arts and things. And you say, oh, God, I've got to do an episode of Neighbours. And I'm always saying, don't worry. It's terrific training. If you can do a month on Neighbours, you could do any part in any production anywhere in the world. It's a bit like the repertory theatre system in England. Just before going home after I'd finished my bit in The Shirelee, they said, oh, look, you better go and see this bloke before you get on the aircraft. We're doing a new show, a drama set in a hospital, and this was late 1956. So I went to see the bloke, who was the casting director, a hell of a nice fellow, and he said, yeah, we're doing this. He said, we're going to have a Commonwealth doctor. But we can't work out exactly where he's from. He could be Canadian, South African in those days, West Indian, anything. But if he's Australian, you might as well play it. So Audrey and I are all ready to get on the aeroplane to fly back to Australia, having finished my Shirley stuff. And the phone rang, and I was called, "Don't go. He's going to be an Australian. We're offering you episode 1, 2, and 4. It was 2 half-hours a week, designed to run for about 5 or 6 weeks. And live to air, no recording of any kind. And I was cast as the surgeon, Alan Dawson, who was a very bad-tempered Aussie. And they worked out that he was bad-tempered because he had a sick wife, and he was worried about her. And if a nurse dropped an instrument, he really went crook. It was a fabulous part, wonderful part. And I did episode 1, 2. Episode 3, I didn't have to work. I went out to watch them shooting it. And then episode 4. Well, we went to air on a Tuesday night in February 1957. The next day, we were bigger than sliced bread. It was extraordinary. And they're ringing everybody, "Don't go, stay there. Have you booked your flight home yet?" "No." "Well, can you delay it a little bit? We've got to extend the run of the show." So they also had to change the script a bit. They didn't want me to be married. So my wife became a fiancé. That was by Friday. By the next episode going to air on the Tuesday, which I wasn't in, I went to watch them shooting, and the producer, Tony Carey, said, "We might just alter it a little bit more." By the end of that second week, she wasn't a wife or a fiancée. She was a sick sister in the Isle of Wight. And nobody ever met her. She was a mystery person over there somewhere, but it meant that I was free to have romances and fall in love and race the pretty nurse off and all that. But it was a fantastic show. We had an audience that, we were on the air for about 3 weeks, and they kept extending it, having to rewrite the stories. And they the publicity guy, Steve, came to see us and said, "Wow, this is a huge success you're having." Mind you, there were only two channels in those days, the BBC and commercial TV, ITV. And we were one of the first of the shows on ITV. And Steve came up and said, "Yeah, we've just got some figures, as much as we can work out with fairly primitive equipment and everything." He said, "But we've got 27 million viewers per episode." And we said, "Oh, never say those outrageous words again." To think that you had 27 million people watching you drop an instrument and get the stethoscope on backwards, you know, it was just too much. But it went on to be an amazing show. Instead of running for a few weeks, it ran for 10 years. I stayed in it for 6. Australia House used to ring up and say, "You're still in the show? Good. Oh, can you stay in it a bit longer? Because this is a whole new image for us. No stock whips, no horses, just doctors. Stay in." And it was wonderful for me because I used to get leave every so often to go off and do a movie of some kind. And we even did a film version of the series. And that led to about 2 or 3 other movies. It was magic time. But my wages for starring in the 27 million viewer show, I got £20 an episode if I was in 2 eps in the week. That was 40 quid, which wasn't bad, in 1957 now. And if I was in 1, I got 25. So it sort of averaged out at about 30 quid a week. But the fact that we were doing the show all the time was an amazing experience. And then I was amazed that the great Albert Finney came into the show for a guest run. And he just had a huge success in the theatre in London. And he wanted to work with us because he was fascinated by the ensemble work we were doing. And we'd heard by then that the producers would only hire actors for our show if they could prove they'd done something like 3 years in the repertory theatre system. Because if you can do 3 years in the repertory theatre system, you can do anything. If you can do 3 weeks in Neighbours, you can do anything. And the standard of work by everybody was just extraordinary. So reliable. Nothing but nothing ever went wrong. Everybody assumed that the set would fall down or the cameras would bump into each other. No. And what we did, of course, was to rehearse meticulously and very hard and very consistently. And by the time we did the show live at 7 o'clock or 7.30, I think, it was perfect. And it was an extraordinarily brilliant experience for me and for all of us. A lot of us didn't realize quite how important the show was being, but it certainly turned us into little telly stars and film stars and whatever that awful four-letter word says, star. I think it was the great Peggy Ashcroft, somebody interviewing her on the BBC, and said, "And how does it feel to be a star at your age, Miss?" I said, "Oh, please don't use that dreadful four-letter word." Star, S-T-A-R, four-letter word, don't use it. But that course gave me, we had to cancel our trip home, and instead of being in England for a few weeks doing the Shirley and nothing else, I was there for about 16 years. And eventually we decided to bring the kids home to show them where Mum and Dad met, married and all that. And when I got home, which was what, 1972, all hell broke loose here too.
Listen to Older Voices, Living History on Ageless Radio. And on today's program is Bud Tingwall.
Alwyn Kurtz very kindly resigned from the lead in Homicide, and they asked me to take over as the inspector in Homicide. A bit embarrassing because I met Reg Jackson, who was the police commissioner in those days. Reg must have been about 6'8". Huge man. And he introduced me and said, "Bud Tingwall is playing the inspector in Homicide." And he looked down and said, "You're too short to be a copper." And then later, some blokes about my height came over and said, "We're the real Homicide." And they were that was all right. But no, it was. I've had an amazing run. And I'm so flaming lazy that I've never done anything to push my career forward. It was all because Owen Weingott sat next to me that I even started doing any acting at all. If he hadn't talked me into taking part in the competition for the amateur dramatic societies, I wouldn't have gotten my first radio job. And it's just gone on like that ever since. If Alwyn Kurtz hadn't resigned from Homicide when we got back from England, we probably would have gone back to England because my agent over there had a lot of work lined up for me. And I'd only recently been starring, as they say, in the West End in a play, which I took over. I wasn't the original person in it, but my agent promised me with a bit of luck I might get 3 months' work in this play. And it was in a wonderful theatre in London, the Comedy Theatre, just on the edge of Leicester Square. Great, great theatre. And I was the fourth bloke to play the lead in There's a Girl in My Soup. And they said, "You'll get 3 months' work." Well, the business went way up, and I did it for 2 years. I made 800 omelettes. I kissed the girl a hell of a lot. And it was marvellous. And when I left to come home, we saved the fare to bring Audrey and I and son and daughter home. And I'd been out of the show about 10 days, and my agent rang and said, "Don't leave London." I said, "Why?" He said, "The show is folding." I said, "Well," he said, "listen, you take over a play that's only got 3 months to run and it runs for 2 years. Then when you do leave, it folds. Don't leave London. This changes everything." I said, "We're only going to see Mum in Sydney. We'll be straight back." And of course, we never did go back. And I do have kind of guilt feelings about that because Tim, my agent, was a hell of a good bloke. And he didn't try to talk us out of anything, but he just, you know, said it would be a good idea not to leave London. And we did. And I'm thrilled to bits because I've had a ball since we've been home. And that was, what, 1973? So there we are. No, I reckon I've just about covered everything. I won World War II all on my own. Yes, I've mentioned that. I was a flying instructor at the end of the war. I suppose that means we should have lost the war, but never mind. I was teaching fellas to fly the Mosquito aircraft. Fabulous aeroplane, all made out of wood. I was very lucky. I flew the two best aircraft in any air force in any part of the war, the Spitfire and the Mosquito. And we were doing our long-range photographic reconnaissance stuff. We were made top secret by a very angry Winston Churchill. I'm sorry, Winnie. but there's a lovely book about what we did in our work called Evidence in Camera. And none of us could really work out exactly why nobody knew anything about us. Some of our pilots were among the most highly decorated pilots in the Air Force. And apparently it was because of this. In the very first few days of the war, there was an air raid organized in Britain to attack, I think it was naval dockyards at somewhere like Wilhelmshaven or somewhere. And they got the fellas, the bombers, all loaded up, and away they went, and they attacked the shipyards. A lot of anti-aircraft fire. And when they landed back in UK, they'd lost a heck of a lot of aircraft. But those who'd survived landed, and there were a lot of press people there asking them how it went. And they said, terrific, we hit every target, smack in the middle. Yes, we lost a few of our blokes, but there. The next day, they sent one of our photographic guys over, and the tragic thing was they missed every target and lost probably about 25% of all the crews. So that hit the newspapers. Apparently, later that day, Churchill stormed into the House of Commons, and he said, from now on, PRU, Photographic Reconnaissance Units, PRU are top secret and not a word about anything they do. And it was like that until well after the end of the war. We had blokes like Wing Commander Warburton who had, God, more, he was only about 19 or 20 when he started getting decorated for ultra gutsy, low level jobs, practically photographing the whites of the eyes of the concerned Germans. But it was an extraordinary experience because you knew you were doing something that was pretty amazing, but you couldn't tell anybody. I remember trying to tell Mum and Dad once that I was actually flying Spitfires on ops, and I thought, well, I can't really do that because it'll be signed, it's got my name, my number, and you know, and then it's a stamp, a censorship stamp on it. So I invented some strange letter about this friend of mine called Bud and what he was doing. And then eventually I said, I've heard Bud's flying Spitfires. And then I wrote another letter. I think I broke every rule in the book. Nobody from Asia here or there, so good. But it was, fascinating. I always felt sorry for the, like, Wing Commander Warburton, who when he was about 24 had I think he had one or two DSOs and about three or four DFCs. And eventually he was flying on Lockheed Lightnings for the Americans to help them learn how to do what we did. And he got shot down and killed. So he finished the war. Nobody knew who he was except, you know, little official things about them. And so the Japanese eventually surrendered, and I felt better about that. If you get a chance to see it, it's worth having a look at. There's a documentary series coming out. It's on DVD called Anzac, and they're releasing it in time for Anzac Day. And I'm one of the sort of narrators. But it is a compilation of all the footage, most of which hasn't ever been seen, from obscure cameramen, usually good, you know, service cameramen. And there are about three of my old mates from the old days, who are the producers and directors. And it was first released on Channel 7, I think, in 1961. And it's going out now as a DVD. And I've been a good boy watching it because I've been interviewed a bit about it on by newspaper guys. And it's extraordinary, the stuff that they shot and found. A lot of it's never been seen before. And they've done it very carefully, because there are some horrific images, but not too many. But golly, what a mess a war is. We lost a bit over 50% of all our mates, especially the fellows who were on Bomber Command, on Lancasters, and the appalling damage they did as part of their enormous raids over Germany. But their losses were amazing, dreadful. And I wish they'd learn how not to do a war. Wouldn't it be good? However, listen, I'm just trying to look at how many hours have I spoken for? No, I don't. When did... I'll get the hook out. That's how to do it. Anyhow, listen, thanks for being a lovely audience. You can wake up now. It's all right. And if anybody wants to know what Margaret Rutherford was like, she was a stupid old drunk and dreadful woman to work with. But we were all in love with her. She was one of the great, absolute greats. And I had the privilege of doing four movies with her, one a year for about 4 years. And I've seen them recently. The family gave me a copy of them all for Christmas. I was so young. God. Anyhow, thanks very much. But if there are any questions about, you know, Maureen O'Hara, anybody here old enough to know who I mean by Maureen O'Hara? She kissed me for my 28th birthday.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. Members of the audience then asked Bud a series of questions. The first one was, where and when did you join Crawford Productions?
This was thanks to Alwyn Kurtz. We were about to go back to England, and Hector called me in and said, listen, Alwyn's just resigned from the lead in Homicide. He said, you've played some coppers in those movies with Margaret Rutherford and everything. Would you like to take over for a while? And that would have been late 1972. And they were at Abbotsford then. Fabulous studio. Small, but wonderful. And I started in January 73.
The next question from the audience was, what awards or medals did you get? Because it sounds as though you deserve something.
Yeah, I do. I really deserve the Victoria Cross. I want a couple of Distinguished Service Orders. No, we didn't. My navigator did. My navigator got a DFC, but I shared him with our commanding officer. But also Bill, my navigator, was what we called a second tour nav. He was shot down as a bow fighter navigator on his first tour. And had he not leant forward to see how they were going, he'd have been dead, because he took an anti-aircraft shell right through the aircraft and it creased his back. So when we were swimming in the North African beaches near our aerodrome, it was very impressive to see Bill sort of with this great scar right across his back. And of course, if he hadn't leant forward, it would have had to have gone right through. But he was good. He was my son's godfather, and we have a very close relationship. And he was, I think, really the reason he was decorated was that he was game enough to get into an aeroplane with me driving. And I did give him a few frights.
Another question was it Emergency Ward 10 that you were in many years ago?
Ah, yes, yes. We never knew what the name meant. And it ran for how many years? 10 years.
Another question was, did you see an item on the news recently where a Spitfire was recently crash-landed?
Yeah, they didn't wreck it, did they? No, that's all right, fine, that's okay. Yeah, they're trying to rebuild them here and there, and I am very nervous about it because those aircraft are very old. And I keep thinking about metal fatigue and stuff like that. You only need a little bit to fall off and you're in trouble.
Bud was then asked about Mustangs.
Mustangs. Oh, they were pretty good, actually, weren't they? Yeah. Like the fellow who landed a Mustang the other day with his wheels up.
Then there was the comment that Bud must surely barrack for the AFL team Collingwood.
What are you talking about, that strange game they play down here? No, I follow Randwick. I was born in Coogee, and Coogee Oval is Randwick's home ground, and they play real football up there.
Finally, Bud was asked as to what his real name is.
Charles William Bud, in brackets, Ting. It was a prenatal joke against Mum. Well, I didn't know until well after she died at the age of 90, and it was a couple of years after she died, and her surviving brother was sitting there very patiently at our place one night, and everybody was arguing about where did the nickname Bud start. And everybody had a sort of silly theory, and Uncle Viv waited. He said, no, it was outside the surf club at Coogee. Was what? And apparently, as the pregnancy was becoming noticeable, Mum, who was rather slim and trim and quite short, was walking towards the surf club, and one of the surf club fellas said, g'day, ain't it? What's budding there? And from then on, they said, didn't say, how's the baby today? They'd say, how's the bud? And I was known as the bud. Now, I didn't know that explanation until long time after Mum died, and I would have loved to have known it in the Air Force, because it used to get back to me that they'd say, there's this bloke swanning around calling himself Bud and pretending to be a Yank. But I don't think you can have a more Aussie nickname than outside Coogee Surf Club.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.